Acts 27 through 2016 and 2036 through 2114. The 66th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 27, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're right in the middle of a relatively long section here in Acts where Luke is just sort of recounting the journey that Paul is on. He spent some time in Ephesus, and he got driven out of Ephesus, and then he traveled up to Macedonia, down the Greek peninsula to Corinth, spent some time in Corinth. He was headed back to at Corinth somewhere along the line. He organized a mission that involved taking representatives of various of the churches in Greece and Asia that had been formed through his ministry. And those representatives were going to travel with Paul, and we find out later that they were taking gifts to help the poor people at the Jerusalem church. So they were carrying some sort of material resources back so that the Gentile church across the world as they knew it at that time, they were coming to the Jerusalem church, to the mother church, if you will, to give them this token of their gratitude, essentially. And that, as we're going to see in this passage, for some reason, Paul sees that as an incredibly important mission. It is important enough that he's willing to die for it. Now, I don't know why. I mean, I think if we were Paul, if we were in that environment, if we knew the cultural prejudices and the sociological, psychosocial dynamics of his time, we would have a better appreciation for why this was so important to him. I don't understand why it was as important to him as it was. But it clearly was, as we will see from the account. But as he was about to leave on this mission from Corinth, he learned of a plot against his life, apparently involving the voyage that he was about to go on. So he changed his plans. His traveling companions went on the voyage. He went by land back up, retracing his steps up the Greek peninsula into Macedonia again to Philippi. And then he sailed from Philippi over to Troas and met the rest of his party in Troas. Troas is in northwestern Turkey, modern-day Turkey. So that's where we left off last week. And interesting thing happens in Troas. Verse 6, we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came to them at Troas within 5 days, and there we stayed 7 days. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered together, and there was a young man named Eutychus sitting on the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep, and as Paul kept on talking, he was overcome by sleep and fell down from the third floor and was picked up dead. But Paul went down and fell upon him, and after embracing him, he said, "Do not be troubled, for his life is in him." When he had gone back up and had broken the bread and eaten, he talked with them a long while until daybreak and then left. They took away the boy alive and were greatly comforted. I'm going to stop there. We'll take this in chunks this morning. Let's stop and think about this account first. First thing I want to comment on with respect to this account is this is an excellent example of the role that the influence that what I would call our pre-understanding has on our reading of the Bible. Because we were not eyewitnesses to this account or to this event that he's giving an account of here. We don't know what was going on. So all we have is this description by Luke, and we are left to fill in the details. We're left to to refer to our own experience, to our own culture, to our own preferences, to our own expectations, to fill in what Paul means by what he says. So, for example, he talks about the breaking of bread. One of the images that would be created in a modern Christian's mind is that Paul is meeting in a very formal and organized setting for the purpose of engaging in a ritual, the breaking of bread, the Lord's Supper in some way, however they practiced it. And we can imagine them sitting around the room solemnly, soberly, passing the bread around, confessing their sins, praying, singing hymns, worshiping. We know the scene. We've done that. We've had that kind of communion service at one time or another. And the language here could certainly suggest that that's what we're talking about. On the other hand, breaking of bread in the Greek idiom simply means to eat. The other scenario that you could envision is Paul coming into town, meeting up with some other believers. They invite him over to dinner. Say, come over to dinner, and I'm gonna get the other believers in Troas, and they're gonna come over as well, and we'll just have a dinner tonight. He goes over to dinner to eat. He doesn't go to teach. He doesn't go to do anything religious. He's just going over to have dinner. Before dinner, they start talking, and they start asking him questions, and he starts answering their questions. And they are laughing, and they are thinking, and they are going in and out of serious conversation. But they are intent. They get so wrapped up in the message of the gospel, Paul's grasp of what that is, his grasp of the Old Testament scriptures, the relationship between the Old Testament scriptures and Jesus and his life and what he said and what he did. Paul begins to explain all that to them. He's answering questions that they've had that they didn't have the answers to. They get so enthralled that, as the text goes on to say, the breaking of bread drags on and on and on. It gets delayed. They don't do it. They would rather learn than eat. It seems to be what's going on here. So they would rather learn than eat. Dinner doesn't get eaten. This whole scene with Eutychus happens. Eutychus is sitting on the windowsill in the third floor. Don't try this at home, kids. Luke comments that there are many lamps or something like that. What does he say? Yeah, many lamps in the upper room. One commentator I was looking at suggested that the fumes of the lamp may have been drowsy making. And that may be what Luke had in mind by mentioning that fact, is that, you know, the air is getting thick, he's getting drowsy, and he falls out the window, three stories to his death, apparently, if we take it at face value, that they picked him up dead. Paul comes down, and I don't exactly know what this means. He fell upon him. I don't take that at face value because we don't know the idiom. I don't know exactly what that would mean. But he did something in response to which God performed an incredible miracle. Eutychus was brought back to life. So what do? They go back up and eat. After having eaten, some people want to talk some more. So they go on talking and asking questions, and Paul answers their questions. And they don't sleep that night. They continue their conversation clear till dawn. And remember, Paul was leaving the next day. So Paul had a sleepless night before he started off on his journey the next day. That's another scenario. Now, which is it? If we allow our experience as Christians in our Christian culture, or our church, or our Christian tradition to dictate how we read the Bible, then it's the first scenario. These are Christians. Obviously, they're doing something religious. But it seems to me that the other is at least as plausible, and there are some features of the account that seem to make that even more plausible. you know, why would you delay? What would that mean if it were this organized formal service where you had everything planned and you're going to do this religious thing and then this religious thing and then this religious thing? It has all the marks of something far less formal than that. And as I say, breaking bread just means eating. And it makes all the sense in the world in this account that we're just talking about dinner here, not the Lord's Supper. My bigger point is, in every passage we look at, that's the dynamic that we have to be aware of. Without even thinking about it, without even knowing about it, our environment, our culture, our experience, our expectations are what we expect to find in the text. That's what we expect the text to be saying. So if we don't stop and think critically and use our imagination when it comes to interpreting the Bible, we are always and only going to see our own lives and our own theology bouncing back at us off the pages of the Bible. It's a crucial problem, because the Bible cannot teach us if we are only seeing ourselves reflected in it. The purpose of the Bible is to challenge and critique me, not to reflect me. So there's nothing really all that important at stake in this particular passage in that regard, but I think it illustrates very strongly how easy it is to not look past our expectations and see what actually might have been going on. As you can tell, I prefer the second scenario. I think this is a very informal kind of thing. The most remarkable thing about this to me is if I have rightly interpreted it, then the most remarkable thing is this phenomenon that I think I know all too well, becoming so engrossed in having clarity, in having my questions answered, in having my intellectual problem solved, that is better than food. It is exciting, it's rewarding, it's fulfilling, it's interesting, it's stimulating, so much so that I would rather have someone answer my questions than eat. I think that's the mark of the spirit of truth at work in our lives, when the truth becomes vital to us, when the truth becomes interesting to us. It seems to me that one of the surefire marks of unbelief and a hard heart and a mind that is dull, is spiritually dull, morally dull, is boredom. Is when we have no regard, no interest, no fascination with the truth. That's deadly. Now, I don't mean that we are intimidated by the process. That can be very innocent. If we're inexperienced, we don't know the language, we're relatively illiterate in the Bible, the Bible is a hard book to read, it's a hard book to interpret, a hard book to understand, and we can be insecure in our knowledge and education and intellectual abilities and be intimidated by that. That's fine. That's understandable. That's human. But to be bored with the content, to not really care what it says, that's a spiritual problem, not an intellectual problem. And what we see evidenced here is the sort of reality that's contrary to that, the sort of reality of the spirit of truth really at work in people, is they become so fascinated with the truth itself that they spend a sleepless night going to someone who knows some answers, and picking his brain and pummeling him for more and more. That seems to be the scene. Now, this remarkable miracle happens here. Why did it happen? Why does Luke record this? I mean, surely there's all kinds of miracles that happened that aren't recorded. What's going on here? What's Luke's concern here? I think the key must be in verse 12. My translation translates that they took away the boy alive and were greatly comforted. But that word comforted is that weird, tricky word that we've run into before. It's the Greek word parakaleo. It's the word from which we get the term parakletos, which is often translated comforter in that weird hymn that we sang, that hard-to-sing hymn that we sang. It refers to comfort. the idea comes from that translation of this word. But the verb form in particular hardly ever gets translated comfort, even in our English translations of the New Testament. I mean, they know that it doesn't mean that. I mean, that's just not what the word means, at least not comfort in the way we think of comfort. It means more like to move someone, to persuade someone, to urge someone, to try to move them to action, to move them to belief, to move them to commitment. It has more the flavor of persuasion than it does of comfort. So I think we could I think where comfort and this word overlap is probably in the word encouragement. I would translate this, they were greatly encouraged. Obviously, they were comforted. I mean, that goes without saying. My kid was dead, and he's back to life, and I don't think that's cool. I mean, I have been shocked with this incredible trauma that is so painful. It's like a stake in my heart, and then it is removed, and it is healed, and that's not comforting. Of course it's comforting. But that goes without saying. I mean, Luke wouldn't even need to comment on that, and we would know that that's got to be the reality of these people's experience. But he chooses to comment on this, and I think it's because he's saying something else. I think he's saying they were greatly encouraged, with respect to the reality and the truth of their faith. It's the combination of two things. Paul has been all night answering their questions and explaining and illuminating the gospel to them, and God came into their midst and performed this incredibly dramatic sign that Paul knows what he's talking about. Listen to Paul. He's sent by Jesus. He's an apostle of Jesus. He knows what he's talking about. If he has the authority to raise Eutychus from the dead, then he has the authority to tell you what the gospel is. Believe him. And I think the combination of the two solidified and founded these believers in Troas in their faith. I don't know where they were at before then. We have no way of knowing. But Luke's comment is, when Paul left the next morning, he left behind a community of believers that were far more convinced of the truth of the gospel than they were the day before when Paul came into town, or the days before when Paul came into town. I think that's what Paul is getting at. Okay, let's go on to... Now, what I'm going to do is we're about to enter into a message that he gives. I want to follow the chronology of events all the way to Jerusalem, and then I'll come back and we'll look more carefully at Paul's message. But we were going ahead to the ship, set sail for Assos, intending from there to take Paul on board, for so he had arranged, intending himself to go by land. And when he met us at Assos, we took him on board and came to Mytilene. Sailing from there, we arrived the following day opposite Chios, and the next day we crossed over to Samos, and the day following we came to Miletus. For Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. Okay, so Paul crosses a little hilly peninsula to a harbor on the other side. While the boat sails around the peninsula, meets up with Paul. They come to Mytilene, and they sail from there to Chios, and the next day they cross over to Samos, and then the next day they come to Miletus. This is the coast of modern-day Turkey with a lot of little islands. And they're kind of following the inside passage of these islands, going from island to island day after day, making their way around to the southwest corner of modern-day Turkey, where we would find Miletus. Well, not quite the southwest, but south-central coast. He passes the harbor that would take him into Ephesus. He passes by and goes around instead to the next harbor, which is Miletus, because he doesn't want to have to spend time in Asia. Okay, if I said that, it would probably mean because I don't want to be inconvenienced. That's not the way I read this here. Paul Paul is going to describe in a second. I mean, when he gets to Miletus, the next thing he does is he calls for the elders at the church at Ephesus and have them hike up over the peninsula over to Miletus, and he addresses them there. So he's interested in seeing them. He's interested in having input in their lives. But he has another agenda. He needs to get to Jerusalem by Pentecost. And he knows that if he doesn't keep on schedule, he's going to be delayed, then he's not going to make it to Jerusalem in time. That's a priority for him for some reason. That's a part of this mission that he's on. This mission is so important to him that he's willing to pass up an opportunity to visit all the believers that are in Ephesus again. Not that he doesn't care about them, but because he does care about them. It's because he knows what will happen. He will find needs there. He will find people that need to talk with him, that he needs to have conversations with, and he knows that he couldn't say no to them. He knows that the needs would be great enough to pull him in, and he would be delayed. So in order to keep to his mission, he would rather not tempt himself with the need to minister to these people, and he doesn't even set foot on land there. Now we have him calling the elders, and he addresses them. I'm going to come back to that, but let's skip over to verse 36. When he had said these things, he knelt down and prayed with them all, and they began to weep aloud and embraced Paul and repeatedly kissed him, grieving especially over the word which he had spoken, that they would not see his face again, and they were accompanying him to the ship. Paul has this understanding that this is the last time he's going to see the people, the believers in this part of the world. Whether in fact that ultimately ended up being true or not, we don't know, because we don't know the full chronology of Paul's history. But in terms of what Paul planned to do, he was planning on, after going to Jerusalem, going to Rome, and then from Rome to Spain, modern-day Spain. And that would have been a long trip, and he would have spent years there because he would want to accomplish the same thing in Spain that he had in Asia and in Greece. So he knew that he was going to be gone for years, a decade or more at the very least. So he's warning them that this is the last you're going to see me, at least for a long time. And they are grieved. They are deeply grieved by that. Paul obviously had meant a lot to them. So they accompanied him to the ship. He got back on the ship. When we had parted from them and had set sail, we ran a straight course to Kos, and the next day to Rhodes, and from there to Patara. And having found a ship crossing over to Phoenicia, went aboard and set sail. So he's making his way past the bigger islands in the eastern Mediterranean down toward the Palestinian coast. When we came in sight of Cyprus, leaving it on the left, we kept sailing to Syria and landed at Tyre, for there the ship was to unload its cargo. After looking up the disciples, we stayed there 7 days, and they kept telling Paul through the Spirit not to set foot in Jerusalem. When our days there were ended, we left and started on our journey, while they all, with wives and children, escorted us until we were out of the city. After kneeling down on the beach and praying, we said farewell to one another. Then we went on board the ship, and they returned home again. When we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemais, and after greeting the brethren, we stayed with them for a day. On the next day, we left and came to Caesarea, and entering the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven, we stayed with him. Now this man had four virgin daughters who were prophetesses. As we were staying there for some days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, "This is what the Holy Spirit says. In this way, the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." When we had heard this, we as well as the local residents began begging him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, we fell silent, remarking, the will of the Lord be done. Okay, he makes his way from Miletus down to the eastern coast of the Mediterranean to Tyre in Phoenicia. There are believers there. He spends some time with the believers there. While he's there, these disciples in Tyre are, through the Spirit, it says, telling him not to set foot in Jerusalem, warning him what's going to happen, what awaits him when he goes to Jerusalem. Then he goes to Caesarea. There are more believers there. Both Tyre and Caesarea, we never hear any word of the church in Tyre or the church in Caesarea in the New Testament, as far as I know. But obviously, the apostles and the disciples who've been left behind in Palestine have been spreading the gospel in that area as well. And we have believers in both of these communities. Then he makes his way to Caesarea, which is basically the seaport for Jerusalem. If you're going to go to Jerusalem, you go to Caesarea and then go inland from Caesarea. That's the seaport. In Caesarea, we find Philip. Philip we've run into before, back in the days of the stoning of Stephen, and right after the days of Pentecost, they selected the seven who ministered to the needs of the people who were gathered in Jerusalem while the apostles attended to the teaching of the Bible and the other stuff that they were doing. And then we see Philip again as the first evangelist to go to Samaria. And then he went over to the coastal region and seemed to have been the first to evangelize the coastal region. He's the one who the Lord led to meet up with the Ethiopian eunuch and to preach the gospel to the Ethiopian eunuch. So Philip is earlier in Acts, is a pretty significant figure. Philip is living now, has apparently settled, and lives now in Caesarea. He has four daughters. The text calls them prophetesses. That's not necessarily the case. The word just means they were prophesying. You know, whether that was a constant in their life or whether that was an unusual feature of this situation, I don't think we have any way of knowing from this text. But in this particular circumstance, God used them to prophesy to Paul. And the nature of their prophecy seems to be as it was throughout Paul's whole journey down here, to let him know, give him a message from God, that what awaits him in Jerusalem is bondage. The Jews are going to hand him over to the Romans. And then finally, as a dramatic counterpoint to that, a prophet that we have also met before, a man named Agabus, he was the prophet who traveled from Jerusalem to Antioch with the revelation that Jerusalem is going to have a famine that led to the earlier visit by Paul with money to help the poor people in Jerusalem when he was located at Antioch and he brought some people down with a gift to the poor people in Jerusalem. And that's the first time Paul sat down and discussed the gospel with the other apostles for the first time in his life. We read that account earlier in Acts. That was Agabus who had that revelation. So we've run into him before. Agabus travels from Jerusalem to Caesarea with a message for Paul, and he conveys his message through a little performance art thing. He takes Paul's belt and he wraps it around his wrists and his ankles and said, "Paul, this is going to be you. This is what's going to happen to you in Jerusalem." Now, if we had read the message to the elders from Ephesus at Miletus, Paul mentions to them there, as we'll see in a second, the Holy Spirit is solemnly testifying to me in every city, saying that bonds and afflictions await me. So it's not even just these accounts of prophets coming to Paul and revealing this to him. Evidently, every place he touches land, somebody prophesies to him that this is what awaits you. What do we do with that? Obviously, knowing the will of God and making decisions as believers is a much more difficult, much more complex process than we often make it out to be and would like to think that it is. There's a tendency. I don't know how strong it is in Christian culture today, but when I was growing up, One of the big deals, it seemed to me, in the Sunday school environment that I grew up in was one of the perks of being a believer is that you could have God tell you what to do. You wouldn't have to be wise. You wouldn't have to be rational. You wouldn't have to be commonsensical. You wouldn't have to do your research. You just pray to God, God, show me your will. God would show you his will, and then you knew what to do. You know, you married that person, you went to that college, you took that job, you took that job offer, you went to this grocery store today, whatever you were worried about, you got the answer. So God would constantly guide your every step, make the decision for you, keeping you in his will. There was a fairly well-known book that came out, oh boy, must have been in their 70s, by a professor at Multnomah called Decision-Making in the Will of God. Maybe some of you have read it, which was taking on and challenging that whole mentality that had been in place probably for decades in Christian culture. You know, very, very good, I haven't read it, but from what people have told me, was a very good, serious critique of that way of thinking. But notice what Paul is doing here. He is having prophets. So in his mind, there's no question. This is not just the opinion of fellow believers. This is not just the counsel of fellow believers. This is God himself going out of his way every time he touches land, going out of his way to saying, Paul, if and when you go to Jerusalem, bondage awaits you. Now, you and I would take that as a sign, I think, wouldn't we? You know, given the culture that we grew up with, if that's not a sign, I don't know what is. This would be a sign that God is telling me, I don't want you to go to Jerusalem, I want you to do something else. But what's interesting is, Paul doesn't see it that way. Paul sees it as just God informing him about what's in store for him. Now, is Paul just being stubborn? Some people have interpreted him that way. This is Paul's great act of disobedience. God was trying like crazy to tell him what he's supposed to do, and poor God, he can't get through Paul's stinking head that he's not supposed to go to Jerusalem. So Paul just stubbornly goes anyway, and God fixed him. He imprisoned him that's what he was warning him against. I don't know how that's supposed to work, but he was being disobedient. That's one way of interpreting this passage. But notice that earlier in Paul's life, there were on two occasions, the Spirit warned him not to go into Asia, so Paul didn't go into Asia. The Spirit told him not to go into Bithynia, so he didn't go into Bithynia, earlier in Acts. I would conclude that Paul knows the difference between the Spirit of God telling him, don't go somewhere, and the Spirit of God telling him, this is what's going to happen when you go there. Those are not the same thing. And Paul recognizes the difference. So why does he go, knowing the outcome? I mean, this isn't even a matter of managing risks. The omniscient God of all of reality, who knows the outcome, is telling him, this is what's going to happen. Why does he go and go anyway? That's the $6 million question. This is a man on a mission. And I don't understand the importance of the mission in the mind of Paul. I mean, can't other people carry money? why is it so important that you go there? I don't know the answer to that. But for whatever reason, I have the confidence that just as Paul spent his entire life feeling duty-bound to minister to the gospel to the Gentiles, he did it because it was his duty. He did it because it was his responsibility. He did it because there was a burden of gratitude to Jesus that he needed to pay. And Jesus had called him to this task, and he could not be faithless to that task. Just as he was carrying the burden of that his entire life, for some reason, Paul acts like a person with a burden to accomplish this particular mission. I don't know why, but that's true seems clear to me. Either he is an evil, obsessed man, or he is a wise, wise, godly man who knows that this is strategic and that this is important. And I choose to interpret it as the latter. So, as he says, when they are begging him not to go, I mean, armed with this information, everywhere he goes, the people are begging him not to go to Jerusalem. Finally, in Caesarea, Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart?" This is hard for Paul as well. He doesn't want to be separated from these people. He doesn't want to be taken away from them. He doesn't want them to be taken away from him. It breaks his heart, but it's got to be done. "For I am ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." Now, that hasn't been predicted. His death has not been predicted, only his imprisonment. But what he says is, even if the prediction was that I was going to die in Jerusalem, I'd still have to do it. I'd still have to go. This is something I got to do. And I'm willing to die in order to do what I believe in my heart and am convinced in my mind is right and is good. That's the courage of Paul, it seems to me. We commented on this a little bit last week in the context of the riot at Ephesus. It's not courageous to be rash and foolhardy and reckless. That's not courageous. That's just stupid. Paul was not reckless and rash and foolhardy. He went by land rather than by boat because he knew they had a plot against him. He does everything he can that a rational person would do to protect himself from harm as he can. But if you can't, you can't. And one reason you can't protect yourself from harm is when you're doing what you gotta do. When you're doing what's obedient, when you're doing what's right, when you're doing what's loving, when you're doing what love and truth and righteousness demands, then it doesn't matter what the cost. It doesn't matter how risky it might be. If you gotta do it, you gotta do it. Courage is that virtue, that strength of character that goes ahead and does the right thing, does what's loving, does what's good, even if it costs. Anywhere from inconvenience to death, it doesn't really make any difference. It doesn't matter that it costs me, I've got to do it because it's the right thing to do. That's the courage that needs to mark us as believers. Okay, see, anything else in here? I'll just comment on it. In this passage, we see, I think, pretty clearly that there was a phenomenon happening in this time that I think was unique to this time. And that is you had a widespread phenomenon of believers prophesying. It sure looks like I don't know any way around it. The kind of prophesying that these four daughters of Philip were doing, the kind of prophesying that Agabus did, the kind of prophesying that some other anonymous people, believers, did throughout Paul's journey, seems to be actually predicting the future. Something like the prophets of old. I think it's Wayne Grudem has suggested that there's a category of prophet here. It's one thing to be Isaiah, where you're actually revealing not only to the nation of Israel, but through your revealing the will of God to the nation of Israel, the message of God to the nation of Israel, you're also revealing it to all of mankind, because the significance of the message is of sweeping universal importance. It transcends a historical time and place. What you seem to have here is a phenomenon where there are prophets who prophesy with only locally important messages, only locally and temporally, locally and temporally bounded messages. If you go to Jerusalem, you're going to end up in prison. That's important to Paul. That's of absolutely no consequence to me. I mean, that message is not worth inscripturating because you're not gonna write that revelation down and make it another book of the Bible, because it has no relevance other than the relevance to the person of Paul himself. Agabus' revelation to the leaders at Antioch about the famine in Jerusalem, that's only as good as the time period in which they lived. They can do something about it. They can respond to it in the appropriate way. But it's not a message into the ultimate plans of God for the universe. So it's not on the order of a revelation that Jeremiah or Isaiah or Ezekiel received. But it is a message from God. And I take this to be a part of the same milieu that we've seen before throughout the book of Acts. The apostles performed miracles. We've just seen Paul raise somebody from the dead. Incredibly, dramatically supernatural things happened during this generation of believers because, as I have suggested before, we're in a transition period, a transition from one whole paradigm for understanding the truth to a radically new and different paradigm for understanding the truth, and that needs to be credentialed. That needs to be vindicated and verified and validated by God himself, so that the world will know this is not just some big scam, this is from me. That, I believe, is why we don't have those same phenomena happening today. Because it doesn't need to be validated anymore. It was validated. It was validated adequately. We don't need it to be revalidated. It's only an unbelieving generation that keeps asking for a sign again and again and again after it's already seen one. That's unbelief that does that. If the validation has occurred, that needs to be as good enough for us just as it was good enough for them. And I think this using people to prophesy was part of the movement of the Spirit of God in their midst to show that his presence was with these ministers of the gospel and thereby credential and validate their message. Okay. I'm running out of time, so just I want to go back to the message of Paul to the Ephesian elders. We won't have time to get into it, so I'll save that for next week. But let me just make one last comment about that as a preface to next week. He sends for the elders of the church at Ephesus. Now remember, Ephesus is in a harbor north of the harbor that Miletus is on, so they would have had to have hiked over a peninsula to get there. But who are these elders of the church at Ephesus? Again, our pre-understanding is going to make a big, huge difference about who we understand these people to be. We know who elders are. Elders, the people who meet every Thursday night and sit around a table and make decisions about what to do with the money for the church and in other issues about our formal organization and our institution that we have established. Is that what Paul's talking about? Is this a formal, organized body of believers? Have they been elected? Have they been appointed? Do they have authority such that if people go against what the elders have decided, they're actually defying God himself? I mean, is there anything like that going on? How are we to understand this? It's interesting. I didn't go back to check this out. I'm just going by memory, which is risky here. But with the possible exception of mentioning elders in connection with the Jerusalem church and possibly elders in connection with the church at Antioch, this is the first time in Acts that we have any group of people with respect to any of these Gentile churches in Asia or Greece called elders, named elders. Now, that's not to say that there aren't elders in all these churches, but it's not become a big deal. This is the first time we have Paul focusing on a group of elders that he calls over to Miletus. I'm inclined to think that Paul did not go around the Roman Empire, city after city after city, and getting a group of people that believed enough that he then had a quorum and could organize them into a formal institution, complete with formal structures and a formal hierarchy, with the elders being in charge, with people who had an office that were in charge. The more I look at this, the more I'm convinced that that most of what Paul was doing was very informal. He just went, as we were going to see in his message to the Ephesian elders, he spent his time those 3 years going from house to house, talking with people, answering their questions, doing all that was profitable, he says, in their midst. And we'll talk about what that is next week. And teaching them publicly. And it seems to me that what it means, I'm giving him authority, so you pay attention. I think rather it was more informal than that. He would sit across the kitchen table. Notice me imposing my culture on theirs. He would sit across the kitchen table drinking coffee, nonetheless, with these people privately in the privacy of their own home. And to people that he, Paul, judged to be mature in their wisdom and in their obedience. And people that he sensed had a calling from God to take that wisdom and that spirit of obedience and seek to persuade others to emulate that. That he encouraged them to take that responsibility seriously. I think something like that is what he means by appointing elders. It's not formal, it's not organized, it's not part of a hierarchy, it's not a part of an authoritarian structure. It's just Paul telling other people to do what he has done. And what he has done is he's taken seriously a charge that he received directly by divine revelation from Jesus. He's taken that charge seriously. It is my duty before God to take this message to the Gentiles because Jesus told me to do that. And as he senses that Jesus is telling you to do that, Paul lets you in on the fact that that's his assessment. That what God has put in you, what God has invested in you, the talents that he's given you, the wisdom that he's given you, the work that he's doing in your heart is such that it qualifies you to lead others. So do it. Go out and be the leader to others that God has asked you to be. And at the same time, at the next house, he's talking to someone else who he doesn't assess as being called by God in that particular way, but is saying to them, you need to have faith. You know your neighbor so-and-so? You need to emulate their faith. They are a good and wise and godly person, and they know what they're doing, and they know what this is all about. Live like they do. Grant them some authority in your life. Why? Because they're worthy of that kind of authority. That's why. You never get any sense anywhere in the book of Acts that the authority of an elder, and for that matter, the authority of an apostle, is never enforced. It is always recommended to people, but there's always this sense that people are going to do what they're going to do. They're going to follow the course that they are going to freely follow. They ought to follow the lead of the elders, but if they don't, then it's at the risk of their own soul. But they have to have the freedom to go where they're going to go. No one can make them obey. No one can make them emulate that which needs to be emulated. So by the elders, I think this is a group of people that is simply a list in Paul's mind. You know, he didn't say to someone, go to the elders at Ephesus and bring them to me. I am inclined to think he said, go to so-and-so and have him come, and go to so-and-so and have him come, and go have her come, and her come, and her come, and him come, and him come, and him come. Bring them to me. I want to talk to them before I leave and before I never see them again. Now again, we are at that juncture. Luke is not clear. Because he doesn't have our experience. He doesn't have our set of lenses. He can't warn me against it because he doesn't even know that it exists. He doesn't know what the 20th century is going to look like. So we're in a position where we have to judge, what did Luke have in mind here? Did he have my culture in mind and my cultural patterns and my institutions in mind? And when he says elders, expects me to think of that the way I would think about that? Or does he have an entirely radically different picture from what I do? Bible interpretation is making that decision. And I don't always make that right, but it is important that we know that we are making that decision to either credit our pre-understanding with being on the right track or recognizing that my pre-understanding is going to lead me to a radically different image than what Luke had in mind. Okay, ran out of time. Your questions, comments, complaints?
Jack, I'm interested in the conscription or the foundation of Paul's journeys to begin with. In this time of spreading the word, is there already an established precedent of Jewish visiting professors going from community to community educating? Or is this an unusual new phenomenon, these travels and efforts of education by Paul?
I believe it's not new. And my only evidence for saying that is remember Jesus' comments to the Pharisees. I won't get this verbatim, but it's roughly, you will travel to the end of the world to make disciples twice as evil as yourself, or something like that. Unless I take it that there's a, I mean, obviously that's hyperbolic and an exaggeration on the one hand, but on the other hand, there must be a germ of historical truth in that there were zealous missionary type Pharisees who traveled around and made disciples.
So Paul is following their example, or is he in competition with them, or is he particularly unusual in this time of spreading the word, in this time of prophesying, do you think? Obviously, we only know about Paul's journey.
Well, we know he's not unusual in Christian circles because we get these little hints throughout the book of Acts that Titus is going here and Timothy is going here and Aristarchus is going here and this guy is going here and this guy is going here, that a lot of his disciples, if you will, are not just tagging along with him. They are going out on their own, on missions of their own. And in fact, early on, we saw Barnabas leave with Mark on a missionary journey of his own. So in Christian circles, it's become very, very common to have teachers traveling itinerantly and spreading the gospel. I know they are in competition with other itinerant teachers. How much that would have been true among the rabbis, I can't say. I don't know. But Cynic philosophers, for example, were notoriously itinerant. So they would have gone around spreading Cynic philosophy. And some of the Stoic philosophers, I mean, Cynicism and Stoicism sort of got merged into amalgam. So you'd have these Stoic/Cynic philosophers wearing their philosopher's robe, traveling from town to town and peddling their philosophy. So yes, they were in competition with that. Among the mystery religions, which were probably the biggest competitor with Christianity, at least on the religious front, you would have cult-like figures. I don't know how itinerant they were. I don't know the answer to that. But I know that the mystery religions invaded from the East and became very popular in the Roman Empire and spread. Something was spreading them. And it could have just been, you know, popular word of mouth. But it wouldn't surprise me if you had cultic figure leader types that were traveling and spreading that.
Do you think God ever uses signs or fillings to help us make a decision, or does he simply leave those decisions up to us without, you know, any help or prompting?
Well, does God move me through those things? Absolutely. I mean, I think God uses every little detail of our lives to get his will done. So my feelings, signs, anything like this can be used by God. The problem is, a passage like this makes it clear how simplistic we are when we start talking about signs, because what we want to think is, I don't know what to do, make it clear what I'm supposed to do. So God sends a prophet and says, in Jerusalem you're going to be bound, the Jews are going to hand you over to the Gentiles and they're going to imprison you. Okay, but my question is, what am I supposed to do? And that never gets answered by our signs, right? I mean, even if God is behind the sign, unless God actually comes and in clear, unambiguous language says to me, don't go to Jerusalem, read my lips. Unless God says that, then I still have to interpret the sign. Okay, you gave me a sign, and what exactly does that mean? in terms of what I should do? Well, either way, whether I'm having to be wise and rational and commonsensical in my decision-making, or I'm having to interpret a sign, either way I have to interpret. Either way I have to be intelligent. I have to reason this thing through and weigh everything. So signs don't really help you much unless it's an explicit commandment. And nobody talks about receiving that. Not, I've never in my life had anyone tell me that they actually heard an audible voice telling me, here's exactly what I want you to do. They say, God told me to do such and such. But if you get back to the bottom of what they mean by that is, I had a feeling or an omen that I took to mean that God was telling me X. Well, was he? They assume so. But they also lived in a culture that taught them that you should be expecting guidance like that from God all the time. So they were set up to and prepared to interpret it as a sign from God. Whether it actually was or not is an entirely different question.
Should we generally be distrustful of that?
I am. And you know why? Watch yourself over time. I get all kinds of hunches that don't come true. I mean, just pay attention. You know, your mind, you'll just get this feeling. You'll get this hunch. You'll get this intuition. And then just watch and see what happens. Sometimes your hunch is right, but sometimes your hunch is wrong. Is that from God? In the sense of an infallible, authoritative revelation, like the hunches that came to Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, or for that matter to Agabus and the four daughters of Philip? I don't think so. I think they're an entirely different category. A hunch is a part of normal human rationality. All kinds of pagans have hunches, and they go on their hunches. And hunches are not bad, and they're not unworthy, because my theory of hunches is it's my mind has two speeds. It has normal speed, and it has warp speed. And when I reason through the evidence that my senses have gathered and my experience and so on at warp speed, and that just spits out a conclusion at the other end, and that's what we call an intuition or a hunch or whatever you want to call it. Is it rational or irrational? Well, it's ultimately rational. It's my mind that has created the hunch, and it is based on evidence. It is based on arguments. It's based on things. The problem with a hunch, of course, is I can't check the steps to find out if I made any mistake in logic, because we can do that. We can. Our intuitions are just as fallible as our ordinary rationality is fallible. So hunches can be wrong, but they're not irrational. They're a rational output of the normal human rationality. And to that extent, they're valuable. It's good to be intuitive. It's not bad to be intuitive. It's good to be intuitive, especially if you have a good intuition instead of a bad intuition. But it doesn't make any sense to baptize that as supernatural. It's not something supernatural happening. It's something very normal and ordinary and natural happening. When God speaks, there's no question about it, I think. When God is revealing his own word and message to me, I don't think I'm left to guess, now, was that God or wasn't that God? I think if you have to guess, it wasn't. You know, you never see a prophet going, okay, I had this message, but like, who is it from? I mean, do I do anything with that or not? I don't know. They melt and fall on their knees and have this incredible sense of uncleanness because they know they're in the presence of God somehow. So I think if we're having to interpret something as probably being a message from God, then it probably is not. In fact, my judgment is that it definitely is not, but you can just call it probably. Okay, well, I think we better call it that. We'll come back to this message to the Ephesian elders next week.